1658 and the original grand jury investigation regarding Jeffrey J. Hummock. Justice Resnick has recused herself from this case. Very pleased to have sitting in place of Justice Resnick and Judge John Kennedy from the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals.
Jim Hummock is present next to the lady.
Mr. Byers.
No, I'm just, we have a swearing in after this. He's not showing up, that's why you support me.
Prosecuting authorities upset that balance?
Does the need to know upset the balance?
If they need to know, on the theory, the doctrine of the need to know, does that upset the balance? Does that weigh more heavily against the code restrictions than if they didn't have to know?
Actually, I think the law enforcement's need to know, Your Honor, is factored into the balance itself. The provision in subsection C of the code expressly says that the need to know is precisely what permitted Mr. Helmick in this case to make the disclosure. The primary need to know when we're talking about future conduct, as we were in this case, is to prevent that harmful conduct from occurring. Mr. Helmick acknowledged that need to know, and that's what propelled him to exercise the latitude that the code gives him by permitting him to make exactly the disclosure that was made.
Is there something in the letter that quote, shouldn't be seen by the authorities, the reason he doesn't want to give it up, or is there, or did he tell them everything that's in the letter?
Although the record does not expressly answer that, Your Honor, it's a penetrating question, and the answer is that the law enforcement authorities know precisely the entire contents of the letter, and they were satisfied with that, and the process that occurred in the trial court was designed specifically to ensure the law enforcement authorities had full access to all the information that they thought was necessary in the letter so that to meet their need to know and to implement their obligation to prevent societal harm.
If that's the case, why didn't your client give them the letter?
My client tried to discharge his latitude and his prohibitive obligations expressed in the code at the same time by disclosing sufficient information in the letter to prevent the harm,
You just told me that, told us that everything in the letter was disclosed by your client.
That's correct.
So why does he not give the letter over to the authorities?
Because the letter itself, as opposed to the import of the letter, is within the definition of secret as contained in the code. And Mr. Hellman reads the code, I think, correctly to expressly prohibit disclosure of the secret.
The letter was not, the letter wasn't received from his client, was it?
Not directly. Mr. Hellman received his letter through an agent that he hired to be an investigator for mitigation purposes.
Did he speak to his client about the letter?
Did he speak to his client? I don't know the answer to that. The record does not answer that question.
Okay. So we don't know whether he received information in a client, attorney-client situation. We don't know whether he received this information in the letter from his client.
Well, actually, we do know because the stipulations in this case trace precisely the chain of custody of the letter. The letter was in the possession of the client's mother, and Mr. Helmick's investigator, who under Ohio law is his agent for purposes of attorney-client.
Oh, I'm sorry, I'm not making myself quite clear. I'm trying to determine whether or not he discussed the letter and its contents with his client. Did that information come to him from his client outside of the letter?
No, Your Honor. The record does not answer that, but the answer to that question is no.
Okay, so all the information that's contained in the letter, no, any of it, wasn't received talking to his client about the case and so forth.
That's correct.
So it's not something he received in that relationship.
Well, it is something he received in the relationship, but not in terms of a contract.
From his client.
Not directly from his client.
It's something that his client didn't verbally tell him in this context.
That's correct. And for that reason, Your Honor, the information in the letter is not a confidence, as that term is identified in Section 401 of the Code, which defines a confidence as information protected by the attorney-client privilege.
And you claim it's not a secret either?
We claim it is a secret.
It is a secret.
Yes. And the definition...
And why do you claim that?
Because it's precisely the language of the Code, which distinguishes between a confidence and a secret.
Mm-hmm.
A confidence is information disclosed that is within the ambit of the attorney-client privilege.
But it wasn't intended by his client that the attorney ever see it.
There's no evidence that it was intended, that's correct. But that is not part of the definition in the Code of a secret. In fact, the definition that this Court promulgated of secret clearly distinguishes between attorney-client communications, which are confidences within the meaning of the Code, and as the term secret is defined, other information, it doesn't say disclosed to the attorney by the client, it says other information gained in the professional relationship. It doesn't say gained from the client, it says gained in the relationship. And this is indisputably...
So it could be gained by anybody, from anybody.
From anybody, that's correct.
Concerning the client.
That's correct. And that is the definition of secret that this court promulgated. And it expressly distinguished between the kind of information that you were getting in on with the questions and oral disclosure.
What did he feel he was violating by not turning over the letter to the authorities?
The provision in Disciplinary Rule 4101B that says, except when permitted under 4101C, a lawyer shall not knowingly reveal a confidence or a secret of a client. Now, the exception to that is the exception that Mr. Helmick acted within when he made the disclosure to law enforcement authorities. He is expressly permitted in the language at C.
So you feel that he felt and you feel that he could tell people about the letter but not let anybody see it?
That's exactly correct. And I feel that way because that's the best sense I can make of this court's rule in 4101.
And you feel there's a distinct difference in the two?
I do. I think there's a distinction between a confidence and a secret, and that distinction is embodied through the language in subsection A. And I think there's a clear distinction in this court code between a disclosure of the secret itself, which is prohibited expressly in section B.
The secret is the piece of paper.
The information in the paper.
The writing on the paper
is
a secret.
The writing on the paper. So
that's why he didn't turn it over, and that's why he was found in contempt.
He was found in contempt because in the face of a trial court order that he responded to the subpoena by turning over the letter, he declined to do so.
But if what you contend that he told everyone about the contents of the letter is true, then didn't he... You violate some confidence or secret by telling people about it?
I think not, because as I was saying, there is a distinction between revealing the secret itself, which is the letter and the content of the letter.
The words on the paper is a secret.
That's correct.
But not what the words say.
To the extent that Section C...
That doesn't make much sense to me, I'm sorry.
In Section C, the code permits the lawyer to reveal. It says the lawyer may reveal the intention of his client to commit a crime and the information necessary to prevent the crime. And exercising that discretion, which is embodied in subsection C, Mr. Helmick disclosed as much of that information as was necessary in his judgment and in the informed judgment of law enforcement officials.
You didn't tell me as much as was necessary. You said that he told them everything that was in the letter. You didn't say as much as he thought was necessary.
You said everything. What I just meant to say, Your Honor, is as much as he felt was necessary and as much as law enforcement officials felt was necessary to prevent the crime, that's as far as the code permits him to go, and that's as far as he went. But he drew the line.
The law enforcement agencies were satisfied with what he told them?
Yes, they were.
They didn't want the letter.
The state is still seeking production of the letter, but we know to a certainty that the disclosure was sufficient to prevent a crime,
but
there's no crime
occurred. Okay. Tell me, Mr. Pryor, tell me why C2 does not apply. Is it because the same reason that he can reveal what's in the on the piece of paper, but not reveal the piece, not hand over the piece of paper?
Well, I think that's right, Your Honor. If I understand your question correctly.
Well, it says it's required by law. There's a court order here. So the distinction
is ridiculous.
If we say that the secret is the piece of paper which contains the information, then he doesn't violate, and the court orders him to hand that over, he doesn't violate the disciplinary code.
If this court orders Mr. Helmick to turn the letter over, he will comply with this court's order.
I'm sure he's going to give it if we tell him to give it.
I think it was the sentiment of both parties in this case. Eventually, this case was going to wait in this court, because to my knowledge, and I think to the knowledge of State's counsel, we have not found a single controlling authority at this level directly clarifying how these provisions of the code, which I think are not self-enforcing, operate in this situation. So I think the intention of both parties was to get this court's guidance on how the ethical obligations that are set forth in Disciplinary Rule 4101 apply to this situation, which is truly, for purposes of judicial decision, a case of first impression.
So just so I understand, and I think I understood from your answers to Mrs. Sweeney's questions, that
that the code permits him to give the information that's on the piece of paper, to orally give that information, or perhaps even write a note, but does not permit him to turn over the piece of paper that contains the information. That's the distinction we're making.
I think that's right, and that's the distinction that Mr. Helmick has had in mind throughout this case, is the permissive disclosure to the extent necessary to prevent harm, as opposed to the prohibition embodied in Section B against disclosing the secret itself. This letter falls within the definition of secret set forth in subsection A, and therefore the code expressly prohibits disclosure of that secret.
I think Mr. Byers, what's happening here is that maybe there's some feeling is that you're quibbling. You're quibbling over a difference without a distinction, or a distinction without a difference. The information's there, why not give the letter? But maybe I'm thinking about it on the other side also. As I recall, Judge Franks instructed Mr. Helmick to read the letter allowed over the telephone, did she not? And he did. So everything in the letter is now in the domain of the public officials, in the domain of the state, the police.
It's in the knowledge of the state, correct.
Except the piece of paper itself.
That's correct.
So it could be quibbling on both sides, if any quibbling.
Your Honor, I've heard your characterization. I don't think either party here is quibbling, although I think there are some very fine distinctions. But frankly, Your Honor,
that's a nicer word, finer distinctions.
Some of those fine distinctions, Your Honor, I think are actually embodied in the language of the code that this court promulgated. And Mr. Helmick has tried, to the best of his ability, to slalom his way through the provisions of the code and try to achieve an answer that balances exactly the same considerations this court was balancing in promulgating the code, which is disclosing sufficient information to prevent harm without intruding or trampling on the sacrosanct nature.
I guess the problem I'm having with your argument, Mr. Byers, is that since we're not concerned here with anyone's rights to, we're not talking about due process or that sort of thing with the piece of paper. Now, that may be underlying all this because I assume the state needs the piece of paper to go forward with a charge. But usually, if a court order, usually if someone is prevented from doing something except where there is a court order, we tend to say the court order absolves you from liability or from the duty to do something. If you've got a court order to do something, that's usually the conduct that controls, isn't it? And here, that's why I guess I don't quite understand why we should interpret this Section 2 of our rule differently than we usually would. It seems to me that if the court decides I want that piece of paper, that's usually the end of it, is it not?
Certainly it would be my hope, Your Honor, that in the event, in response to this court's order, Mr. Helmick disclosed the letter itself, the secret. Certainly Mr. Helmick would not expect to be found to have violated the Code of Professional Responsibility. So I think that's correct. To that extent, to the extent there is a final binding order by the highest court in the jurisdiction compelling him to disclose the secret, I don't think it would be fair or even conceivable Mr. Helmick would be disciplined under those circumstances. I think in the trial court and in the Court of Appeals, Your Honor, there was a legitimate question in Mr. Helmick's mind as to whether the court order at the trial court or the appellate court's level should be considered to be the final controlling authority on the meaning of this rule. And that's why this case is here.
Independently of the disciplinary rule, that there's some reason that your client does not want to give up the piece of paper, and there's some reason the state wants it. And so a trial judge has made a decision which you would like to have reviewed.
That's right. Now, I will say in response to the thing you just said, Your Honor, that other than the code and Mr. Helmick's good faith reading of its express prohibitions, there is no extrinsic consideration that's leading Mr. Helmick not to turn over. He reads the code as prohibiting it. I believe the court's rules reference to an order, court order, compelling disclosure would require there to be an extrinsic body of law the mandated disclosure, because on its face, as you read it, the rule prohibits disclosure. But if there were to be an extrinsic body of law that in this instance compelled disclosure of the letter, then that would support a court order. But that is ultimately the legal decision for this court.
In a collateral matter, Mr. Byers, I've always read 101C3, the word may to be shall. You seem to make the point that a lawyer can come into knowledge of his client about to commit another crime and not have to report it.
Candidly, Your Honor, that's an oddity in my reading of the rule as well. You all know certainly better than I, the evolution of the meaning of the word may in legislation is generally construed to be permissive as distinguished from the word shall. Extrinsic law, longstanding Anglo-American law that treats this subject, uses the word shall and makes disclosure to law enforcement authorities of a future intention to commit a crime mandatory. But this rule says may. In any event, Mr. Helmick did exercise, if that be discretion, exercise his discretion.
I understand, but if it says may and it means may, then he would not give up the letter, he didn't have to report at all.
If may means may, then he would have been acting within the spirit and the language of the rule not to have made the disclosure. And if that seems at odds with appropriate social policy, and it certainly does to me, then revision of the rule to that extent would certainly be appropriate. Because as I said, other than this codification of that law, my reading of Anglo-American law would say shall.
Thank you, Mr. Byers.
Thank you.
Mr. Mayor.
You knew that was May. I've always read the shell.
Hey, please support Mr. Byers. My name is Dean Mandros. I'm here on behalf of the appellee. We're asking that the lower court's rulings be upheld.
Mr. Mandros, if you'd have found out that Mr. Helmick had this letter and hadn't done anything about it, hadn't reported it to anybody, would, I don't mean you, but the prosecutor's office, would authorities have reported him to disciplinary counsel?
Well, Your Honor, that's interesting because Mr. Byers said the rule does say may. And while this court may have interpreted it in the past as shall, the word is right there, but...
So you would have considered that to be a violation, wouldn't you? I think I would have. That's why I'm asking you.
Well, I think that's kind of why we're here today, to get some clarification on this point. I don't agree with Mr. Helmick's position, but I understand why he felt the need, the way this DR was written, preserve the issue and come before you folks to get a clarification, because you're right. A strict reading of this, he had no obligation to come forward. And
but the code
may have occurred. And is that the better policy? To say no, because this arguably, I don't agree that it was a secret, but we'll say for the sake of argument it was a secret, and felt compelled to maintain it. And it's clear from the information that there was a threat made on the life of the state's witness. And I want to disagree with a portion of Appellant's brief where he tries to characterize this letter as a future crime. In point of fact, by way of the stipulations, both paragraphs 16 and 17, it was a crime committed at a minimum, an offense of intimidation, and quite readily arguable, he solicited someone to commit the offense of murder, both of those which would constitute crimes committed. And
does the defendant or the client or whoever he is here, however we're going to, he's not really Mr. Helmick's client for purposes of this secret because he didn't get it that way, supposedly, but does he have any standing?
Well,
maybe he objects.
I think clearly not, because what needs to be emphasized is that Mr. Helmick's original client, Mr. Foley, is on trial for aggravated murder. Weeks before trial, he sends a letter to his brother asking him to accomplish certain tasks. That letter ends up in the hands of Coley's mother. The mother is contacted by the investigator hired by Mr. Hummel, primarily for litigation purposes, and inadvertently, this letter that Coley had no intention of Mr. Helmick seeing ends up in his deeds.
Which is why I want to ask the question, have the parties agreed here that the, in terms of the definition of secret in A, 4101A, the second half of that is other information gained in the professional relationship. We have that from Mr. Byers, but it is that the client has requested be held inviolate, or the disclosure of which would be embarrassing or would be likely to be detrimental to the client. The client we know he hasn't requested it be held inviolate because he didn't even expect this to happen.
Correct, but I think certainly Mr. Helmy could fairly conclude that.
Detrimental.
Yes. Now, we don't as a debtor.
And the detriment is in as much as the information has already been disclosed. It's been disclosed under the privilege to do so.
Well, I think Mr. Helmick's fear, and candidly the reason that we wanted the letter, was to explore whether that letter could be used for additional charges against Mr. Coley. So if we got the letter and it was presented to the grand jury hypothetically along with other information, that may have been what caused the grand jury to return the indictment, so certainly it would be detrimental to Mr. Coley. However, we don't necessarily agree that the letter was a secret. The Sixth District Court of Appeals below found that it wasn't a secret in terms of what this DR contemplated. But even if it is a secret, we think that the policy issues way on the side of the lawyer's obligation to turn it over to the authorities. Not unlike this court has suggested, if it may be that you folks will consider this rule.
Before you get to the policy, why isn't it a secret? Because you get to policy by saying even if it is a secret. But first you said, wanted to quarrel with the idea that it was.
Well, I don't feel it is a secret in contemplation of the rules, because I view it as physical evidence. It's physical evidence of a crime committed. And the case law is clear, at least in other jurisdictions, that it's improper for an attorney to become a repository of physical evidence of crimes committed on behalf of clients.
And of course, the argument is that this is physical evidence in a communication mode.
It is, and certainly any document is going to contain information or be a communication, but that doesn't relieve it of the fact that it is still physical evidence. And tax information, for example, are documents and records that are often subpoenaed and disgorged from unwilling clients. And I don't think that just because it contains information gives it the umbrella of being a secret. This is a physical piece of evidence that was used in an effort to have a crime committed. The point of fact is evidence that a crime was committed.
So you would not take the position that investigators that find out information about their client, maybe even the client doesn't want you to know,
I think it is, we are splitting some hairs here. It is a very delicate issue, but because it's not only that it is document. And if it had been just verbal and not written, it would have absolved him from any responsibility to turn this information over. In point of fact, it was written. It is a piece of physical evidence. And I think the policy issues involved mandate that a lawyer has an obligation higher than the client. He's an officer of the court. And we've cited cases, even this court, in Muscovitz versus Mount Sinai, I know Mr. Byers is familiar with, that was a civil prejudgment interest case, and the discovery of the insurance company's file said that these privileges, in this context it was an attorney-client privilege, must yield, in certain circumstances, in the interest of justice. This secret is a step below that confidence because this wasn't information that went from the client with the intention of going directly to the lawyer.
But when you have a client and you investigate their case, you learn all sorts of things that your client doesn't directly tell you. And I'm concerned if you write the rule to say these things aren't a secret, then you open
question, Your Honor, in this context. Professor Whitmore was quoting the Louisiana versus Green case that I cited, has written that a document should avail itself to the subpoena process. It could have been had from the original recipient. So if we could have subpoenaed that document, which we could have from the brother, we have the right to get that. We could have subpoenaed it from the mother. We have the right to get it. But all of a sudden, it shouldn't become unavailable to the state because it inadvertently ends up in the hands of the lawyer. So I would say, if it also contained a confession to this crime, we should have access to it if we knew about it. But that isn't the situation. And I agree with you, the better argument is that it is physical evidence of a crime committed. At a minimum, the offense of intimidation, and it goes up. And the policy issues at stake are the lawyer's obligation doesn't start and end with the client. He is an officer of the court. We're interested in the proper administration of justice. Thankfully, Mr. Helmick, and I think from a literal reading of this rule, did not have to disclose the information he did.
You make that physical evidence point on your brief on page 5 and 6. And as I read that, Mr. Mandros, I was thinking, what happens if your client comes in? And I want to give it two instances, two different scenarios. Your client comes in and deposits the gun on your desk that was used to commit the crime. Second example, or his brother brings it in and puts it on your desk. Does the lawyer have an obligation to turn that over to you?
I think clearly yes. And we have not found case law in Ohio that deals with this point. And to a certain extent, I've been in front of this court maybe 6 or 8 times, and today I don't have that one dread of fear where I wait for one of you to say, Mr. Mandros, you fool. Didn't you just read our decision to say versus Smith when we just detailed what you're supposed to do? There really is a paucity of case law, especially on this point in Ohio. But other cases have said clearly that And as has happened before, the lawyer's obligation is to turn that over. That Louisiana versus Green case, Washington versus Colwell is a case where it was a knife that was turned over. And clearly, you don't want lawyers all of a sudden to turn into a depository to launder or hold illegal items, evidence of crimes. That isn't the role, the function of the attorney. So I would say in either situation, whether it's his brother.
Okay. So if it's a physical object, then it should be turned over. Does that then also go to any kind of confession he gives to the lawyer? Supposing he writes it out. Yeah, I can remember saying to one of my clients, write down what happened. Absolutely. And he did. You have that, then I give that to you.
No, that is
that's a physical
confidence. Because it goes from the client directly to the lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
The distinguishing thing about this case is he had no intention of ever having that in his hands.
Yeah, but you said if the brother even brought it in, it would be required to turn over to you.
Well, in this situation, we're talking about evidence of the commission of a separate...
Yeah, I see that distinction.
But that's a more interesting... If he wrote a confession to his brother,
mm-hmm.
we could have access to it. If he wrote a confession, put it in an envelope, sealed it, and said, give this to my lawyer, clearly not. If he admitted the crime to his brother, yes, we can
So maybe that's why... Maybe that's the reason some defense lawyers I know never ask, did you do it? That really happens. I always did it the other way, but I can see now why maybe... If you don't know, you can't, no harm, no tell. Huh?
Well, I guess some lawyers would rather just not do it. Maybe it would just clutter the matter for them. But Mr. Byers, I anticipate that we'll step up and talk a little bit more about a policy consideration and that it will cause a chilling effect on attorney-client relationships. But I don't think that what happened at all in this case, because this wasn't the attorney-client communication. And the argument has been expressed that perhaps if this information is gained by an attorney, he or she will be more reluctant to turn that information over to the authorities because they feel that it will be detrimental to their client. And I don't feel that's an issue at all. I don't see why if this court gives guidance and modifies this rule or issues an opinion in this case that says, no, lawyers in this type of narrow circumstances are obligated to turn this information over to the authorities. I think the presumption has to be that the lawyer is going to follow his or her ethical obligation and do just that. And it's not a situation where he really is going to interfere with that lawyer-client discourse because there wasn't a lawyer-client discourse. It wasn't intended to be a lawyer-client communication. And it is by mere happenstance that he received it and we had knowledge of it. So,
Counsel, your light's on, but I'm concerned that I think there is an agreement here that
he does his best with the red light.
The key question is not the fact that you read the entire contents of the letter, and you're not arguing that if a transaction like this occurred, that suddenly authorizes your office to go on a total fishing expedition of defense counsel's file. So we're talking about a fairly narrow concept, but something broader than just this letter, because we could all get hung up just on the fact that you already know everything that's in it, and we shouldn't probably.
Right, I don't think that is a factor. I don't know that is the deciding factor. There are many facets to this issue. It's truly, the authorities who read the letter, we know what it said, but it is, again, a physical item that I don't think that lawyer has a right to maintain. In the Washington versus Olaf case, it was a similar issue where the lawyer received a knife from a client that was accused of homicide. The court in that case structured a balancing test and said that
if we don't agree with you that it's, that this turns on the fact that this is physical evidence of the crime itself, then you
I think by the way the stipulation is structured, we have no recourse but to reach that. I don't think all communications have the lawyer would have an obligation to turn over all communications made by his client. Certainly not. But you, what brings us here is a position that is that.
Thank you, Mr. Mander.
Thank you.
Mr. Byer, you've used your time, but you may take 30 seconds.
Could I take the first few of those, please? The key with the rule, the key is information, both with regard to confidence and secret. It's information. Both are, that's the key noun, is information. And then the verb, the key verb, is thou shalt not reveal. So it's the constraint is reveal information. In the scenario that we have with regard to Mr. Helmick, where the revelation of information took place as a result of an exigent circumstance under C3. Now what we already have by Mr. Helmick is a revelation of information. So now we're talking about the you know, turning over the physical document. But is that, should that be, I'm wondering about his argument. Does he remain constrained even though he's only been constrained about revelation of information and that has already occurred? He's already done that. What's the letter? You know, it doesn't say thou shalt not give up. You know, a gun isn't information anyway, or I suppose you could make the argument that the gun does offer information, but I'm not sure why he should be constrained further. He has revealed information.
I think your question gets to the centralizing points in the scope, but I think the answer that the code gives is precisely the answer that Mr. Helmick believed the code provided from the start, including today and his argument today. The permitted disclosure of information is defined by C3, which again uses the word information, reveal the information necessary to prevent the crime. The breadth of that permitted disclosure will vary from circumstance to circumstance.
Yeah, but the information necessary to prevent the crime is the same, every syllable, arguably, of this letter was revealed. Has already been revealed. How do the words limit it?
You're exactly right. Let's assume, as I think would be true, Your Honor, that in this case, the breadth of the permitted disclosure was exactly the same as the entire body of information. This case is here, though, for interpretation of this rule across the board.
Right.
And it is crucial for that purpose that this court distinguish between permitted revelations under Section C, which is a revelation of information, and prohibited revelations that are prohibited by Section B. And what the state is attempting to do here is is not in force the permitted revelation, or if it were Michelle rather than May, even the mandatory revelation necessary in the language of the rule to prevent the crime, but of the secret itself. Several of your honors asked the penetrating question, is this a secret or not? It is information. The law in the context of the Fifth Amendment and testimonial information and in the context of privilege draws sharp distinctions between communicative physical evidence and non-communicative physical evidence. And the letter, although it is a physical object,
Would the non-physical be information?
I'm sorry.
Would the non-physical evidence meet the rule in terms of it being information?
Oral disclosures would certainly be information.
No, I thought you said physical evidence.
Okay,
I said it wrong.
The letter itself in this case is information because the only reason the state wants it is for its communicative content, and that is not a distinction that is invented in this case.
Mm-hmm.
This court is familiar with distinctions of Fifth Amendment law between testimonial and non-testimonial documents. A parallel distinction exists here. This court should be very reluctant to disturb the balance that was carefully struck. We have the right result. We know in this case a balance that produced exactly the right form of societal protection without producing the attorney-client relationship. The rule works as written. It should be applied as written. The decisions of the law should be changed because they threaten to disrupt the rule, because they threaten to disrupt that balance. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Pryor. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion. Marshall, please return to court.